We're talking about a new study on housing access in the La Crosse area. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The study found housing needs are disproportionately affecting residents of color, and the study found Black residents are more likely to be denied a home loan. We're looking at the takeaways with your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234. What is your experience finding housing, especially around La Crosse? What about low-cost housing and rentals? Are there options available to you? Is the housing stock high quality or is it subpar? We're at 800-642-1234. Caroline Gregerson is the Community Development Administrator for the City of La Crosse, and she joins us from our studios in La Crosse this morning. Caroline, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, the study was required by HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, since La Crosse gets community development block grants. What are these block grants? What do they do, and how do they relate to affordable housing?
Well, the city has received a community development block grant for about 45 years, actually, and it comes from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and it's a flexible source of federal revenue for states and cities like La Crosse to develop community development solutions and especially improve the quality of life for low and moderate income households. And so part of that commitment as a result of receiving those funds is that we look at ways to affirmatively further fair housing. And in La Crosse, we find that a large percentage of those funds are spent on devising housing solutions to meet the needs of our residents. So this study plays perfectly into informing how we expend those funds.
And explain how some concrete things that this HUD money has done, this block grant money has done for the La Crosse area.
Well, we have a long-standing partnership with our local technical college here in La Crosse, and we've been building affordable single-family housing across the city by partnering with our local technical college. So they actually build the house, and the city supports in renting that lot, tearing down an older home. And also as a result of that study, we've also started looking at how we can incentivize affordable rental housing in La Crosse. And that's kind of a new initiative. We've started that for about 5 years, and we provide loans to see affordable multifamily housing get built in La Crosse as well.
How much of a guide do you use the study to make decisions on how to improve and change housing stock in your area?
Well, quite a bit, because number one, actually, it's a requirement of HUD that we look at this study every time we do our annual plan for the year. And then at the end of the year, we're also required to report on how we're doing in terms of carrying on the recommendations in the study. But for me personally, you know, I'm just busy with my day jobs trying to get projects out the door. So this is kind of the one time that we can really take a look at the research, be really thoughtful and look at what the data is telling us. So we're not just doing projects because, you know, they feel good, but there's some data behind them.
Caroline, what are the biggest issues facing the La Crosse area right now when it comes to housing and housing equity in particular?
Well, the number one issue that came out in this study is housing affordability, and you mentioned that earlier. So while in La Crosse, you know, our housing prices probably are considered modest and compared to national averages, these costs are still unavailable to some of our low-wage workers and our seniors and maybe single moms. So I'll just give you an example of what the study showed, that to afford a two-bedroom in La Crosse at $793 a month, you need to make at least $15 an hour. Well, we can think of a lot of jobs that aren't paying $15 an hour. To afford a three-bedroom, let's say you're a mom with children or a mom and dad with children, you need to be making at least $21 an hour to afford a three-bedroom. And there's certainly, you know, many, many jobs that pay under $21 an hour. But in particular, when it gets to the equity aspect of this, we found that 76% of Black households are paying more than 30% of their income in rent, sometimes even 50% of their income in rent. So whereas white households, more than a third had some sort of housing issue, either paying more than 30% of their income or rent or in overcrowding, again, that was 76% of Black households. So a big difference there in terms of housing affordability being a larger need for our Black households in La Crosse.
And that that rent check each month or that mortgage payment, that shouldn't be more than perhaps like a quarter of your budget. Is that right?
Ideally, but the standard we're looking at is actually more than 30%
higher when
you were considered not to have affordable housing. But like I said, 20% of our citizens in La Crosse are paying more than 50% of their income in rent. So, and one of the things is, you know, we are a college town. So there's a large demand for rental housing from college students in our area. And then the housing recession maybe meant that a lot of people suddenly didn't own their home. They're now in the rental market and they're competing with the college students. And there's a very high demand for rental in La Crosse.
We're talking about a fair housing study with Caroline Gregerson as our guide. She is La Crosse's community development administrator. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to address racial disparities in housing? Are you a person of color living in La Crosse? What's your experience with the housing market? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Caroline, the study looked at the city of La Crosse, La Crosse County and Monroe County. Was the analysis similar among these places or in terms of what you found in housing equity?
Well, that's interesting. So first of all, Kate, I'll just note that this is actually the first time we made this study regional. Last time when we did it in 2011, HUD only requires that we look at the city of La Crosse. But this time when we did it, we thought, you know, housing is really a regional issue. What happens in La Crosse affects what is going on in Onalaska. So we decided to make it regional, which was very interesting. And so Monroe County covers Toma and Sparta, and that is a much different area. It's a little more rural. And so what we found over there is perhaps their Hispanic population is actually the fastest growing population and has a lot of needs over there. Whereas in the city of La Crosse, you know, the population with the most needs and the fastest growing population was our African American population. So, yeah, just a little differences. So we definitely had different information coming out. And we also kind of took a countywide perspective as well. That actually drew out some issues in terms of unaffordable housing for people who own housing, which was interesting as well.
We're talking about a housing study in the La Crosse area that crunched federal census data and also used resident surveys, hundreds of surveys and interviews to get a read on housing access in the city of La Crosse County, and Monroe County, the whole region. We're going through it with Caroline Gregerson. She's the Community Development Administrator for the city of La Crosse. Getting your questions, your reactions, experiences, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to address racial disparities and access to safe, quality, affordable housing? Are you a person of color living in La Crosse? What's your experience like in finding a home? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a new housing study and disparities among La Crosse area residents. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The report is required by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and it's meant to gauge areas for improvement in city housing. As part of the report, a poll of 900 residents of La Crosse and Monroe County revealed that no African Americans in that sample size was a homeowner. What do you think should be done to address racial disparities in securing affordable housing? Have you lived in other parts of the state and in the La Crosse area? How does La Crosse compare? Join in at 800-642-1234. La Crosse's Community Development Administrator Caroline Gregerson stays with us for this conversation. Let's go to the phones now with Kathy joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. So my question is in regards to the statement that you guys are a college town. How does the college rentals work into your figures? Does that skew some of your results?
Kathy, thanks. What about those college rentals, Caroline?
That's a good question, Kathy. There are ways through the HUD surveys that they are actually, when they're looking at affordability, and we're talking about those figures of, you know, more than a third of La Crosse households are experiencing unaffordable housing. That does not include college rentals in those figures because they're able to do some things with the data to make sure they're looking at households through the census data. But in terms of, you know, looking at average rents and, you know, those rental prices, that certainly does include college rentals.
Because that will drive up the costs, I mean,
yes,
because
definitely.
Of that demand.
Mm-hmm.
What did the study find on racial disparities in home loans and home ownership?
Well, Kate, that was, for me, the most surprising aspect of the study. It showed that even accounting for income, we saw that black households were more than twice as likely than white households to be denied a home loan. And so, first of all, for the city of La Crosse, again, that census data, they don't survey every household. It registered that there was 0% black households. So we know that's not quite true. When they look at the county, it's about 12% of black households are homeowners. But again, in the city, there were so few black households owning a home, it registered at 0%. But then secondly, the survey actually looked at over 10,000 records of loan applications. And again, like I said, they found that more than double, you know, you're twice, if you're a black household going into the bank, you were twice as likely to experience a loan denial. And again, that is accounting for income. Now, what does that mean? Well, what we're looking at is we need to dig down a little bit into those numbers. First of all, you know, the sample size was fairly small, only 43 home loans to black households where they applied were what we were able to analyze. So we kind of want to get together with the banks, dig into those numbers, and figure out what kind of solutions we can do to address that issue.
Yeah, because this now goes into a whole nother area, the financial sector. I mean,
mm-hmm.
This isn't exactly something that you can fix with housing stock. It really has to do with the banks now getting involved.
Yes. So as part of the study, we did do focus groups with bankers and lenders because they definitely have to be part of the conversation. But I'll be honest, that is not a program we've ever done. It would be a new area. And I definitely think it would be, you know, bringing the banks together and coming up with a solution together as to kind of what do those numbers mean or what kind of programs could we do together to encourage more black households to feel comfortable applying for a loan. And then once they're there, how can we help them get through the process? We talked to one homeowner who just described really how intimidating the process was. They might not have as many people in their network that have been through the process that kind of can coach them through. I know when I just bought a house, you know, it was my first time, and It was a lot of work, I had family and others helping me through the process.
You had support systems there.
Yeah. But why is this important? Well, we see home ownership as a wealth-building tool and a neighborhood stabilization tool. So it's definitely something that's important to the city. Out of this report, digging into how we can address the racial disparities in home ownership is something we're digging into. And in fact, Kate, just in general, across every racial and ethnic group, we just in general saw that they had a higher denial rate, again, accounting for income than white households in La Crosse.
So segregation in La Crosse and the region has been decreasing in the past several decades, but it's still an issue. What does racial segregation look like in this part of the state when you look at the neighborhood makeup, and how does that play into housing inequality?
Well, it's, nationally, it has been a part of our nation's history for a long time. For example, we know back in after World War II, the Federal Housing Administration actually refused to provide mortgage insurance on homes located in communities with high populations of color. And so that practice led to a lot of the neighborhood segregation that we see today. But in La Crosse in particular, it's interesting because, our history of racial segregation, actually in the late 1800s, when there was a lumber boom, we actually had 1 to 2% of our population that was black. And then after the lumber crash, that population of black households went down to less than 1%, actually 0.002%. And that number never really came back until the mid-1900s. And so some historians in La Crosse have pointed to perhaps it was discrimination back in the early 1900s that might have been a part of the fact that, we didn't have a significant population. But now, our minority population in La Crosse is growing rapidly. It's one of the fastest growing populations. And the good news out of the survey is it didn't register significant segregated neighborhoods in La Crosse. And that in part is probably because still our population is 90% white. But where there was some neighborhood and racial segregation, we did see it between our black and white population in La Crosse. And then, just conducting our focus groups and our listening sessions, certainly we heard a lot of stories of minority households just not feeling welcome or experiencing some housing discrimination that they didn't know how to report.
Talking with Caroline Gregerson, she's Community Development Administrator for the City of La Crosse, as we look at the results of a Fair Access housing study that is required by HUD. We have an email here from Paul from Eau Claire, who's wondering what housing models from other states would make sense here. Caroline, have you looked outside of Wisconsin to see what could work here in terms of fair housing models that you could draw on from elsewhere?
Yeah, we've definitely looked at other cities. One is our neighbor in Minneapolis. They do have what's called a housing trust fund, and it's basically includes those federal housing HUD dollars brought together with some city dollars to provide capital funding to create affordable housing. So we've started our little La Crosse pool of funding that's much less than what Minneapolis has. And we found a lot of success with that because, a lot of when you're charging lower rents than what it costs to build, there's going to be a subsidy involved. But the other models that we've looked at, in particular and to address a lot of our homeless issues in La Crosse, is we've looked at how can we just partner better with landlords. So we've taken some models actually from Seattle, who has actually developed partnerships with landlords to say, how can we address some of our homeless issues? You, landlord, would you be willing to relax some of your standards to help house someone that's formerly homeless, and we, as the different provider agencies, are going to guarantee that you get a rent check and you get some case management services and support services along with that. So for me, you know, I think continuing to build a capital fund and maybe working with our suburban areas on this would be what some next steps will take, but also looking at what is in the existing housing stock and how can we work better with landlords to open up the housing that they do have. And I know we're running out of time here, but just quick one example. You know, I did hear some stories of people that were families trying to rent in La Crosse.
Yeah.
And because they were in a family unit, they were kind of denied housing based on being in a family. So they might need that larger four-bedroom unit in La Crosse, but the landlords would be like, well, it's, you know, this is a college neighborhood. We're not sure that, you know, your family's going to want to be here, you know. Mm. So, you know,
lots of issues. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Caroline Gregerson is Community Development Administrator for the City of La Crosse, and she joined us from our studios in La Crosse as we've been talking about a fair housing study that found housing needs are disproportionately affecting residents of color in the La Crosse area. Coming up, Governor Evers made his first appointments to the UW Board of Regents this week, and we'll take a look at the region situation after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about appointments to the UW System Board of Regents on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The UW System Board of Regents consists of 18 members, 16 of whom are appointed by the governor, and they're subject to confirmation by the state senate. And then of those 16 members, all but a couple serve seven-year terms. Governor Tony Evers put forth two candidates this week, plus one student regent, for the record. What questions do you have about the work of the regents and the actions that they can take? What changes or improvements would you like to see the UW system implement? We're at 800-642-1234. Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So until Monday, the regents were made up of almost entirely of Governor Walker appointees, but then Governor Evers has made his first picks to the board. What do we know about these three people? Who are they?
Right. So Governor Evers this week, he appointed a Eau Claire attorney named Ed Manydeeds, who actually was on the board until 2017. So he's you know, used to this position. And he'll be on there for a number of years to come. And the second person is a Madison philanthropist named Karen Walsh, and she will be, I think this is her first term, and she's known for, you know, her and her husband have this foundation that has donated millions of dollars to UW-Madison, especially to the School of Medicine and Public Health. I think they gave a $10 million gift in recent years. She's also a heavy donor to Democratic politics,
including Evers' campaign.
Right, that's right. So she's given about $14,000 to Evers' campaign for governor, and $50,000 to the Democratic Party of Wisconsin just this month. Ed Manydeeds also has given money to Democratic politics, including Governor Evers. Not nearly as much, but he's been giving money to Evers since Governor Evers was state superintendent. So he's been a longtime supporter.
And then there is a student nomination, a student region seat?
Right. So there's always a, you know, a student regent, and this person is, her name is Olivia Woodmansey, I believe is how you pronounce it. She's a UW La Crosse student. And she'll serve a two-year appointment as a student regent and take the seat of a UW Eau Claire student.
And so we've been seeing a lot of talk about the backgrounds, the donations, the you know, where these donors you know, are sending their money in terms of Karen Walsh and Edmund Manydeeds. Why is the Regents become such a political hot button, Molly?
Well, I think it's just the nature of the board. It's a very powerful board. The people that sit on this board oversee millions of dollars in, you know, how state funding is going to be spent. They potentially spend million or oversee millions of dollars in contracts. It oversees the entire university system in the state. So just by nature, this board is like a super school board, you know, so to speak. It's just they oversee a lot of important decisions and a lot of money.
Governor Evers himself used to be a regent, stepped down for his campaign for governor, and his former position as state school superintendent automatically gave him that seat on the board. Do we know if Governor Evers' experience as a regent is informing the appointments he's making?
I know that when he was a regent and he was elected governor, he made some comments about how he wanted to basically overhaul the board at the time. And well, currently the board is made up of many appointees from Governor Scott Walker, who was a Republican. And Governor Evers, when he was elected, said that he wanted to replace many of them and replace, in his words, he said he wanted to replace them with people who weren't his friends or who worked for him. So kind of taking a shot at Governor Walker's appointments, you know, suggesting that Governor Walker was handing out favors to people or something like that.
We're talking about the appointments Governor Evers made this week to the UW System Board of Regents and how they're impacted by the lame duck session legislation. Molly Beck is our guide. She's state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the lawsuit challenges of the lame duck appointments? Do you support what the state Supreme Court decided? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Molly, the UW system, giant organization. Can you go a little bit deeper into what the job of the regent entails, this 18-member board, what they get to decide?
Right. So they establish policies for the system whenever there is, you know, some sort of incident that comes up and the system wants to respond with creating new policies. For example, there was an interest in overhauling or changing or just looking at what the policies were related to sexual harassment and assault. Like the UW Board of Regents would be involved in looking at that. They also, you know, make decisions about, buildings on campus and what they're going to be doing with, you know, the state funds that they get or the tuition money that they get. They get to just make all the rules and policies and regulations and decisions that the university system needs to make is, you know, they often have a say in that.
And they grant tenure appointments to faculty members as well.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are the UW Board of Regents paid positions? How much work is involved?
I'm not sure how much work they're doing outside of the meetings, you know, when they're not meeting all together, but they do have meetings, you know, regularly throughout the year, and those meetings are often 2 days long. So if they're meeting in Madison, it'll probably be like a Thursday and Friday, they'll have a 2-day meeting because, you know, they're from all over the state. So it's much more when you think of like a school board, like I said before, you know, it's like a couple days a week at night, but this is kind of like an all 2-day event.
The appointments Governor Evers made this week are awaiting confirmation by the state Senate. Help us understand what that confirmation process looks like.
So that's another political process. And right now the Democratic Governor Evers and the legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, they're not getting along right now, and there's a potential that the Senate will not confirm these appointments because of another dispute that is going on involving what you mentioned before, the legislation that was passed during a lame duck session in December that limited the power of Evers and the Democratic Attorney General. So the Senate leader has said that he might, not confirm some of the appointments Governor Evers has made because he's not happy with Governor Evers' decision to vacate some previous appointments that were confirmed during that session. I know it's very confusing, but the Senate needs to vote to confirm the regents that he's appointed, but they can still serve until that happens. So if the Senate takes a vote and rejects them, then they'll be out of the job. And until then they can serve until that happens.
So that could be months from now.
Right. Okay. Which is what happened with the lame duck session. There were two appointments that Governor Walker had made, and they were in that position for months. And then in December, the Senate took the vote to confirm them. And because that legislative session is being challenged in court, those confirmations got thrown into uncertainty. And but you can serve until the Senate actually takes action.
Let's go to Lori now, joining us from Vernon County with a question. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about the Board of Regents in general and their relationship to the various university foundations, because like the UW La Crosse Foundation or Oshkosh Foundation, for example, last year that had all that money going amiss. Is there a relationship between the two? I mean, can you talk about that, please? Thank you.
Thanks, Lori. Yeah. Molly, what do we know about the relationship between the foundations, which are independent from university coffers, but how do they mix and mingle with the regents?
Right. I'm not exactly sure how the relationship works there. I know that the UW system, Board of Regents, oversees the entire system. So I believe that they would make policies involving how the foundation works with the campus that it supports. But I'm sorry, I don't actually know the specifics of that specific relationship.
So if the Senate does not confirm these appointments, does Evers go back then and bring two more candidates into the mix, or what happens?
Yeah, I mean, if the Senate rejects his appointments, then he will, appoint more people. And the same thing might happen. So it's not clear, but it's also worth noting that, that is a very rare occurrence if it's ever happened, so there's a lot of, things being, people are saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we dare you to do this, but it's possible that, everything will just work out normally, like it usually
does. There's some posturing going on.
Right,
have we heard from Wisconsin's Republican leaders? How have they responded to the governor's choices since they came out Monday?
I haven't seen any reaction to them, actually. I think the legislative leaders are mostly focused on what's going on with the regent seats that were kind of thrown into uncertainty over the lame duck lawsuits and the rulings that vacated them and then restored the appointments. There was a lot of back and forth there, and it all kind of happened at the same time.
Talking with Molly Beck, she is the state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Governor Evers this week put a pair of candidates forward to serve terms on the UW System Board of Regents. He also put forth a UW La Crosse student to serve in the student seat. Getting your reaction, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the System Board of Regents? What changes or improvements would you like to see the system implement? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the UW System Board of Regents here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Governor Tony Evers put forth two candidates this week to serve on the board, along with one student regent from UW La Crosse. The sitting board is almost entirely made up of Governor Walker's appointees. There are 18 regents, and they oversee UW campuses and pass policies and rules for the campuses. So they're setting admission standards, they're approving university budgets, they're granting tenure appointments for faculty. What actions do you want the UW System Regents to act on? Should Governor Evers be able to replace regents who were appointed by Governor Walker? What are you following from the lame duck legislative action? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Molly Beck is our guide. She is a state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Let's go to the phones now with Joanne joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Joanne. What's on your mind?
Good morning. The regents need to value education. So these appointees need to value education and realize the power that that education brings to the citizens of our state and how valuable that is. And the regents should not be friends. The regents that Scott Walker had appointed were sympathetic with the very ultra conservative movement of which Walker was a part of. We need someone who believes in education, is willing to fund education, and not people who want to defund education. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Joanne, thanks for the call. So it sounds like she's saying, you know, these regents really have to check their politics at the door and act in the best interest of students, Molly.
Yeah, and I think, you know, no matter which party the governor's from, I think, you know, it's not just, you know, former Governor Walker who is appointing Republican-friendly regents. You know, obviously, Democratic Governor Tony Evers has appointed two people who have given money to Democratic politics. So it's something that, you know, has happened under, you know, both kinds of administrations. And they take up, you know, educational issues and it's not like, you know, they're running this sort of board in favor of just one governor. You know, it's, you know, the decisions are related to the university system. But, you know, obviously like in 2015, the board, voted up to, you know, remove tenure from the university's rules and regulations. And that was in accordance to a state law that was passed. So that's something that people saw as a very political move in favor of Republican politics.
Molly, let's look a little bit closer into the lame duck session. Earlier this week, the state Supreme Court ordered appointments made by Governor Walker in the lame duck session, then rescinded by Governor Evers, restored. So there's been this back and forth. Can you help us understand what's happening with these 82 appointments?
Sure. So like I said before, when the lawmakers convened in a lame duck legislative session, they confirmed 82 appointments that Governor Walker had made to the UW Board of Regents and also a bunch of other boards and commissions throughout the state. And because that legislative session is now being challenged in court, and there was a judge in Dane County that threw out those laws that they passed in that session because he found that legislative session to be illegal, the 82 people that were confirmed in that session, he also vacated their positions. And that started kind of a process that first began with the people leaving their positions, and then the Republican leaders, you know, got a stay in another court of that ruling. So the people who were in those positions believed they had their positions back, but Governor Evers' office did not think that. So there was a lot of uncertainty about whether the people actually had their positions or not. And now we just got a ruling from the state Supreme Court saying that, you know, that those people do have their positions back. At one point in the process, there was Public Service Commissioner Ellen Nowak, who is a Walker appointee. She tried to go back to work during that legal dispute, and she was blocked at the elevator doors. She now is back in that position, and she's going to be seeking back pay and reimbursement for healthcare costs in the time that she was not working. So it was a few months of uncertainty.
Yeah, uncertainty and confusion. So with the two candidates put forth this week, who is in those seats now? And how have they, who are they, and how have they been weathering this back and forth?
Right. So Ed Manydeeds, he will replace the board president, John Boehlein, who, and that's a very powerful position on the Board of Regents. And Karen Walsh will replace Regina Milner. So John Boehlein is also from Eau Claire, and he has been the board president for a couple years. Regina Milner, she is from, I believe, the Madison area. I'm not sure about that, but so the Boehlein position is what's interesting, is that he's been president and he's been on the board since 2012.
And education was such a huge campaign topic in last year's gubernatorial race. Governor Evers comes from this background in public education. Do we know if he'd like the Board of Regents and their help to instill some changes or policies in the UW system? Like, is there an agenda?
Governor Evers, you know, he does want to increase funding for the UW system generally. He put forward a capital budget, which would, you know, I think half of the capital budget, which was, you know, over $1 billion, would go just toward UW campuses. Obviously, he was the state school superintendent and, you know, values public education because that's what his career was in. So he has, you know, kind of made it a point, especially on the campaign trail, that he wanted to, you know, build the funding for UW system and its campuses, and kind of drew a contrast between that and the previous administration, saying that they did not support UW education like they should have.
One thing that stands out, too, is that these 18-member regents, they come from all walks of life, certainly the philanthropic, the legal background, but they don't exactly come up through academia. What do we know about how that plays a role in what policies they see fit to set for students when they're so far removed from the classroom?
Mm-hmm. I think it's, if you think about a regular school board, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, the school boards are made up of people who have an interest in education or an interest in being in a position of making decisions, you know, powerful decisions about a system like that. And I think that kind of board will draw people who believe that they are, you know, they can make a decision about, you know, that they can handle big contracts, or they know how a lot of, you know, millions of dollars should be spent, or, you know, they think that they have a you know, if they're have an accountant background, you know, they have an accountability role too there. So I think you see people that they might not, you know, have education degrees, but they have an interest in education or just overseeing systems because they feel like their talents can be used there. So
in the last few seconds we have with you, what are you watching for going forward with the regions?
I think it'll be interesting to see how Governor Evers, you know, shapes that board into a board that he, you know, is his, because Governor Walker did that with the previous board and the current board too. So it'll be interesting to see, as he replaces positions, how that board gets along if they're, you know, of, you know, different political backgrounds.
Molly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we've been talking about Governor Evers' first appointments this week to the UW System Board of Regents. Just ahead, the Wisconsin National Guard's response to sexual assault is under federal review. We'll talk with a sexual assault response coordinator and a victim advocate from the Wisconsin National Guard about their work. Stay with us for that conversation right here on the Ideas Network.